From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore the historical and modern policies undermining Black homeownership through the new book, Plundered. Then we'll hear how the economy in Wisconsin's Northwoods is being impacted by changing winters.
So that's really just like a key part of the Northwoods is having enough snow, enough ice to bring people up here to enjoy the winter.
Plus, we'll speak with Jim Gaylord, who was honored with a Unity Award for training marginalized Milwaukeeans in the construction trades.
There are two type of people. One makes excuses, one makes it happen. And I just try to mentor these guys that can be you, or you can be better than that. You can learn from the mistakes that we made and take it even further.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Black home ownership in Milwaukee has been a focal point in the city's continued struggle with racial equity. A 2022 report by the Wisconsin Policy Forum found the city had the lowest rates of Black and Hispanic home ownership among 10 peer cities. But Milwaukee isn't alone in the struggle, and there have been many historical and current factors that have undercut Black Americans' ability to buy and keep their homes. A new book called Plundered: How Racist Policies Undermine Black Homeownership in America explores the obstacles facing Black homeowners by following two families in Detroit, Michigan. Bernadette Atuahene is a professor of law at the University of Southern California Gould School of Law, who specializes in property law. She's in Milwaukee today for a conversation at 6:30 this evening at Boswell Book Company. Ahead of that, she joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to explore how these policies impacted Black homeowners in Detroit and throughout the nation. Atuahene begins by explaining the premise of the book.
Plundered is really the story of two grandfathers who were once poor sharecroppers in their native lands. Both came to Detroit to work at the Ford Motor Company's River Rouge factory in the early 1900s. One, Grandpa Bucci, was white and came from Italy, and the other, Grandpa Brown, was Black and came from North Carolina. And we need to know a lot of these racist policies really began when Blacks started appearing in these northern cities. And racist policies were existent in the South, obviously. But when Blacks came to the North in great quantities during the Great Migration, like Grandpa Brown did, we saw a lot of the racist policies in the North. Everyone was coming to River Rouge because it was, you know, $5 a day, but it was also one of the Ford Motor Company's dirtiest and most dangerous factories. But the job helped these two men and their families escape poverty and really enter the middle class. So although neither grandfather had an easy life, my book, Plundered: How Racist Policies Undermine Black Homeownership in America, goes through how racist policies affected the Black grandfather's ability to pass along wealth to his grandchildren, while the Italian grandfather and his descendants were allowed to thrive. And the racist policies I'm talking about include racially restrictive covenants, redlining, blockbusting, urban renewal, predatory mortgage lending, and most recently, inequitable property taxation, which we can talk about more in a minute. And I call these racist policies because they are written and unwritten laws and processes that produce or sustain racial inequity. And racist policies exist regardless of intentions. So although Plundered begins with Detroit and the Ford Motor Company, it's not just about Detroit. It's a national story about how racist policies undermine Black homeownership in America.
As you say, some of these things were explicit when we're talking about racially restrictive covenants, when we're talking about redlining. As these two men were really first starting out in their careers, what were the policies that were dictating where they were able to live?
Yeah. It's so many. So Grandpa Bucci, who, again, he was a sharecropper from Italy, in no way had an easy life. When he left Italy after the Great War, he went first to the coal mines of France before he came to River Rouge. And he even had one of his fingers cut off, you know, working in these factories. So he in no way had an easy life, but at no point did he have to deal with racially restrictive covenants, which prevented him and his community from occupying certain homes in the suburbs where the houses were cheaper, bigger, and they had better amenities. Although Grandpa Bucci never had an easy life, him and his community never faced redlining, which is where the federal government drew an actual red line around Black communities, indicating that they were a credit risk. And so this redlining really deprived Black neighborhoods of investment. And so the deterioration you see in the Black communities is an inevitable result of redlining. Although Grandpa Bucci had it hard, he never had to deal with blockbusting, which is when, because the presence of Black people could reduce values because of redlining, when Black people moved into the neighborhood, real estate intermediaries would then tell white people, you guys better sell and get to the suburbs before you lose all the value of your home. White people would flee. And anytime you sell quickly, you don't sell at full value. And these intermediaries would then resell to Black people, making a nice little profit. And that was a phenomenon called blockbusting. You know, although Grandpa Bucci had it hard, him and his community never had to deal with urban renewal. I can go on and on, but the main idea here is the book doesn't tell you, it shows you how these two grandfathers, both of them coming to America at the same time, both of them former sharecroppers, both of them poor, one of them purely because of the color of his skin, does not deal with all of these racist policies I've just articulated. And hence their progeny, their grandchildren, have very different outcomes. In Grandpa Bucci's case, his grandson, Robert Fecano, still lives in the house that he inherited from his grandfather. And the home in the suburbs is worth over $250,000. Myresha in the book, who is Grandpa Brown's progeny, his grandchild, she inherited his house, and the house was worth less than $10,000. The house was not a valuable asset. It was, in fact, a money pit because of these layers and layers of racist policies.
So one of the things you mentioned was this idea of urban renewal. Now, here in Milwaukee, that meant a variety of things. We'll be most familiar with the destruction of the Bronzeville neighborhood here in Milwaukee. What did that look like in Detroit?
Yeah, in Detroit, again, this is happening in Black communities, like you mentioned, all over America, Detroit, Milwaukee, Philly, Memphis. You know, what is not acknowledged is these urban renewal programs have the purpose of trying to remove blight. But nowhere in the structure of the program did they acknowledge that the blight that these urban renewal programs were trying to remove were caused by redlining, were caused by the federal government. Because when you put a red line around a community saying that they're a credit risk, right, and then banks and then other lending institutions and financial intermediaries do not then invest in this community, the inevitable result is blight. And so it was the blight created by the federal government through redlining that these urban renewal programs came in to ostensibly try and clean up. But along with, you know, cleaning up this blight, they destroyed entire communities. Whether your house was blighted or not, whether your business was blighted or not, if you were in the designated area, your home was torn down, razed, right, to create something new. And what you need to realize is when they razed these Black communities, they not only razed bricks and mortar, but they also destroyed a lot of social capital. When people live next to each other for a long period of time, neighbors become like family. And then you have social regulation that happens when you have thick social capital. And then through urban renewal, communities are then dispersed. Because of segregated housing, there's only a few places that these Black displaced families can go. And so now these new neighborhoods, instead of being neighborhoods where you have thick social capital, through urban renewal, you've created neighborhoods of strangers. And when you have neighborhoods of strangers, you have, you know, violence and crime and distress are going to run wild because you don't have the social controls necessary to put the brakes on that. And so urban renewal through this mass displacement really creates communities of strangers. It creates root shock. It's a psychological concept. I mentioned Mindy Fulilove. She's a psychiatrist at Columbia. And talks about the emotional and psychological impact of having your whole community removed. That's what Black communities dealt with, again, not only in Detroit and Milwaukee, but throughout the nation.
What are the stories that really stick out to you that really illustrate how these different things impacted the people at the center of this book?
Yeah, it's a great question. So a lot of people think about racist policies as something of the past, but you know, they continue on today. And one of the main stories I tell in the book is the story of Myresha. She saw this yellow bag hanging from her door in 2015. She snatched it down as quickly as she could before her neighbors got wind of what was going on. But when she looked down her block, the yellow black bags were attached to most of her neighbors' doors as well. And in Detroit, the yellow bag is the kind of universal symbol of property tax foreclosure, because this yellow bag provides the legal notice required to foreclose. But it also brings shame because it announces to the entire neighborhood that the homeowner is going through tax foreclosure. So since 2009 in Detroit, 1 in 3 homes has completed the property tax foreclosure process. We haven't seen this number of property tax foreclosures in American history since the Great Depression. So the real question is, what in the world is going on? And I did a study that found that between 2009 and 2015, in each of those 7 years, anywhere between 53 and 84% of the properties were being assessed in violation of the Michigan State Constitution, which quite clearly says no property can be assessed at more than 50% of its market value. And it was the lowest valued homes, like the one that Myresha lived in, that were most affected. And when you think about this again, it's not just a Detroit problem. Detroit is ground zero for a national problem. Nationally, the statistics show that Blacks and Hispanics, on average, pay a 10 to 13% higher property tax rate than whites for the same bundle of goods, which equals about $300 to $400 more per year. This is a driver of the racial wealth divide that our nation has not yet begun to deal with. And so this is a quintessential example of a racist policy, which is a policy or procedure, again, that differentially impacts different racial groups. And these property taxes are a more modern example of a racist policy. But, you know, city officials, when I interviewed city officials for the book, they all explained the property tax foreclosure crisis with stories of personal irresponsibility. For instance, one official said, well, Professor, Detroiters just don't want to pay their taxes. Another said, Detroiters bought homes they couldn't afford. And one official even had the audacity to tell me, Joy, that Detroiters decided to buy purses instead of paying their property taxes. And I interviewed over 150 Detroit homeowners who lost their home through tax foreclosure. And I found that most of them had internalized these narratives of personal irresponsibility. And mind you, people are losing legacy homes that have been paid off, because if there was a mortgage on the home, the bank would have taken it before the local government could. So tax foreclosed homeowners blame themselves for losing mama's house, for losing granddaddy's house. There was so much shame and self-lambasting, Joy, that when the interview was over, I had to call many people back and tell them about my study and about the illegally inflated property tax assessments. I had to let them know that systemic injustice was hidden in the complex property tax calculations. And really, this information allowed them to shift from blaming themselves to focusing on the structural injustices involved. And Myresha did not have a yellow bag on her door because she was irresponsible. She was up against racist policies, which operate silently in the background, leaving its victims foregrounded and thus drawing all the blame. Everyone can see the yellow bags, but they cannot see the practices and policies that made sure that these yellow bags were on almost every door on Myresha's block. They cannot see the practices and policies that led to redlining, the practices and policies that led to blockbusting, that led to racial covenants, and that led to all of these various racist policies. What people see is the Black people in the community, and so hence they're drawing all the blame for these invisible structures.
There is a program to help people here in Wisconsin with inflated property taxes. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Absolutely. So at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, the law clinic there has teamed up with community advocates in Milwaukee, offering services, because as I told you, this is not a Detroit problem, it's a national problem where Blacks and Hispanics are paying higher property tax rates than whites. And so At the University of Wisconsin, if your home is below a certain value, you can call community advocates, and for free, the program will look at your property taxes, first of all. And if, in fact, through number crunching, the program determines that your house is being overtaxed, the program will file an appeal, a property tax appeal, free of charge. And again, the program only serves owner-occupiers. If you're a landlord, this program is not for you. But if you are a homeowner in Milwaukee, and I believe the numbers, if your home is worth under $200,000, please call, again, community advocates. Have the program check out to see if, in fact, your home is being overtaxed. And again, they will file the appeal for free. The clinic at University of Wisconsin-Madison, alongside of community advocates, is just doing fantastic, marvelous work on this.
For sure. Well, Bernadette, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, and we are looking forward to having you here in Milwaukee.
Joy, I'm looking forward to coming to Milwaukee, and thank you so much for this interview.
Bernadette Atuahene is a professor of law at the University of Southern California Gould School of Law. She is also the author of Plundered: How Racist Policies Undermine Black Homeownership in America. Atuahene spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers ahead of an event this evening at 6:30 at Boswell Book Company. Last winter was the warmest on record in Wisconsin, but things are looking different this year, and that's good news for the North Woods. That part of the state depends on lots of snow and ice to support winter tourism. Katie Thorson shares her outlook from Rhinelander on how winter recreation is going this year and how they've adjusted to changing winters with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz.
Winter has finally arrived in the North Woods, which is very exciting for everyone. It was definitely a slow start to winter. The one nice part was we had the cold temperatures early on the season. So that meant, you know, we could do ice fishing and ice skating and have those kinds of activities. But it was the latest opening for snowmobile trails and some of the other snow sports just because of our lack of snow going into this winter. We had the return of the Eagle River Ice Castle this year, which is always a big thing and kind of a good sign for ice conditions in the North Woods.
So talk about the significance of winter recreation to the culture and the economy.
I mean, the North Woods is a tourism economy, and so we need tourist activities to bring people up here. And so in the wintertime, that is really snowmobile trails are the big one. They bring people to those bars that are kind of off the beaten track and those restaurants off the beaten track, but are on the snowmobile trails. Ice fishing is a huge one. I mean, in the summertime, fishing is a big draw. That continues to be in the wintertime. So you need that stable ice to get people out there. You know, cross-country skiing, snowshoeing, fat tire biking has really picked up in the last couple of years, where we have, you know, organizations dedicated, volunteers are out there grooming all these trails to make sure that it succeeds. I mean, and really it is a lot of volunteer power because people recognize how important tourism is to the North Woods. And they also just enjoy it themselves and want to have good trails to get out on. So that's really just like a key part of the North Woods is having enough snow, enough ice to bring people up here to enjoy the winter.
So last winter obviously was so extreme. Are you hearing conversations now among people sort of saying, maybe we need to rethink how much we count on snow or ice for the future of our tourism in the winter?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember last year, Vilas County, the ATV clubs were going to the county and asking if they would open up the trails to ATV because they're shared use. So in the summer, they're for ATVs. In the winter, they're for snowmobiles. But because there wasn't enough snow to open for snowmobilers, but it was hard enough that ATVs could be on them without ruining the trails, they went to the county saying, hey, can you open these trails up? But it would take too many ordinances and wasn't able to do that. You know, there was Monaco Winter Park is a huge cross-country ski area up here. They put in disc golf courses and left their trails open to bikers in the winter because there wasn't enough snow, but they could still get people out in other ways. This year, kind of in response to last winter, Boulder Junction created what they call the Glide, which is an ice skating trail through the woods, because their thought was, okay, we didn't have enough snow for snowmobiles, but last winter could have gotten cold enough. If you're in the woods, we could have kept the ice on for this. So this could have been a way to bring people in there. So they tried it this year, and I mean, it was really a big success early in the season before we had snow, like I was saying, that they were able to get people up there on the ice skating trails and into town. Again, spending money, going to restaurants, staying at hotels, those kinds of things. So there is some of that already happening. And then I think there's a lot more discussions too of kind of what the future of some sports or areas looks like.
Warming winters, but we're living with climate change. Do you see some form or another of more conversations among the people that you work with and the stories that you tell that are beginning to factor in? How do we maintain the life, culture, and the economy that we love up here with the changes that we're experiencing?
I don't know that it's kind of made that jump to, hey, we're having a couple bad winters right now, but not necessarily. No, I definitely think there are people saying, yes, this is climate change. We need to have action because this is our future. But I also think this winter and the last one are kind of outliers for what's been predicted for climate change for our region. If anything, we're supposed to get more snow because more precipitation. I think the thing is, if it'll be come down to snow, ice, rain, because our temperatures are warming. But if you look back before last winter, I mean, the last few winters before that have been some of our snowiest on record. Like we just got buried. So I think people are still looking at these last two winters of, yes, we can do more to help businesses when there are bad winters. But I don't know that many people or majority of people are in the mindset that this is what our winters look like going forward. I mean, right now the snow is great. I mean, it was amazing what the turnaround was about 2 weeks ago when Vilas County had opened their trails and Iron County had opened their trails for like a couple weeks. Oneida was hesitant too, just because up here, landowners give easements to clubs to have the snowmobile trails. But if there's not good snow, snowmobilers tend to go off trail, and then property owners get mad because they're going on their property where they don't want them to be. And so they'll sometimes take back those easements, which will ruin an entire segment of snowmobile trail. So sometimes counties are hesitant to open up their trails if there's not enough snow for that reason. But Oneida finally opened. A lot of the other neighboring counties have now opened their snowmobile trails. The skiing's gotten better, the snowshoeing's been great, and it's just amazing how everyone's mood just turns around up here. It's just everyone's happier to be able to get outside in this way. Businesses start doing better, getting more people in, hotels are filling up. So it really is, it's amazing just how much some snow makes a difference up here.
So, encapsulating the warming winter question around recreation, how would you put that in a nutshell of what's being experienced there?
I think the last 2 winters, this one and last year, are definitely making people think more about how we sustain tourism in the Northwoods during bad winters. I think we're still going to have snowy winters and people, are still going to be coming up here to snowmobile and still enjoy those things. Ice fishing I've heard is great this season so far. But I think there's a lot more conversations that are starting to happen of, okay, what do we do during these bad years, and how do we manage those years? I mean, last year, all the tourism chambers, organizations, and things like that were reaching out to state and federal lawmakers, being like, help our businesses. They're dying right now because if I mean if your business is to rent snowmobiles, you had no business last year. Other ones can make do. There's still people coming up here that love the Northwoods and still wanted to support the economy, even if they couldn't get out snowmobiling. So they came up and still supported businesses where they could. But I just think there is more conversations about, okay, Well, this didn't work last year, so what can we do? And I think like Boulder Junction was a great example of that. Them saying, hey, we couldn't bring in any snowmobilers last year. What can we do to try and change that? So they built an ice skating rink through the woods. Like, that's really like a little trail through the woods. That's so cool. The Rhinelander High School up here a couple years ago built a dome to have like an indoor football field and track and like pickleball courts. But they host like softball tournaments through the winter months. And businesses here are saying, this is great. This still fills our hotels. It's still people coming to our restaurants. The ice arena obviously is indoors, so they can still hold tournaments and stuff like that. So I think people are also looking at things that they did before we had banned winters and saying, hey, this was really great for us up here. And this really helped our businesses. So I think. I definitely think it's more of looking around of how can we do that. And also I think there's been talks, way before bad winters of can we bring another industry to the Northwoods? That's so that when we do have really slow tourism seasons, I think the same thing could happen in the summer months too. If you get, washed out rains, who's going to come up and spend their weekend in the rain? I mean, our summer tourism has been incredibly strong. Like it's amazing. I think on the flip side too, that because our summer tourism is so strong, I think there's some businesses, and this is not all for sure, but there's some that do so well during the summer months that they just close in the winter. They're like, I don't need this. We have a lot of businesses that will close between kind of like end of fall tourism until the snowmobile trails open because it costs them more to operate with how few people they get through the door than it does to just, it's better to just shut down and not have those operating costs and then reopen when tourists return. But again, I think people that I talk to at least are of, hey, these last two winters sucked. We're not a fan of that. So what can we do to kind of make it better? What can we do to help kind of thing?
Katie Thorson is the news director at WXPR based in Rhinelander. She spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz for our Thin Ice series. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen on demand. Two Milwaukee musicians recently released an album that's a jazzy twist on the musical Fiddler on the Roof. We'll hear from them in about 15 minutes. But first, we'll hear from one of the 2025 Unity Award recipients recognized for his work training marginalized Milwaukeeans in the construction trades. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine features the five winners of its 2025 Unity Awards. The awards highlight people and organizations that are making Milwaukee a more inclusive and equitable place to live. One of the recipients is Jim Gaylord. He's a master electrician and vice president of Ezekiel Community Development Corporation. Gaylord was recognized for training marginalized Milwaukeeans in the construction trades by rehabbing blighted local homes. Lake Effect's Ex-Grit Nunez speaks with Gaylord about what motivates his mentorship and how Ezekiel Hope helps transform lives.
Why is it important to you to pass on the skills and the knowledge that you've developed over your 40-year career or over 40-year career to others?
I got two reasons for that. Number one, my mother had over 52 foster kids over the course of her life.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't know how she did it, and I didn't understand it at first. You got a new brother, a new sister from the third grade on. And I'm like, they're getting some of my love. But I knew the challenges that they had. Her school burned down in elementary stages, and they weren't building another colored school in Mississippi at that time. She learned how to survive, learned how to be a woman. She was a great cook, made soap, made clothes, made quilts, you name it. And she married a guy that finished out of the service, who was a hard laborer, hard working man, and they moved up to Milwaukee to the Black Migration to get a better chance for education for us, me and my brothers and sisters. So that's one thing. I've seen her keep every kid in the neighborhood, cook for everyone in the neighborhood. But she taught us about service and doing the right thing. And secondly, I know the challenges that I faced coming up. I knew it wasn't fair. I grew up in a neighborhood, again, off 4th and Lloyd, 4th and North over that area, that people pushed me to do something different. They saw a little something in me and they said, you don't do this. Even though I wanted to, even though we're going to learn by the hard knocks. And because of that, I knew I had an obligation to try. Even though I wanted to hang with all my friends, even though I did a lot of stupid things over the course of my life that I thought were fun, I do have a checkered past. You know, when I did finish college, in Oshkosh, I used drugs quite a bit, you know, recreational drugs. Thought I was having fun. But even all of that prepared me to do what I do now. You know, coming from the hood, using drugs, selling drugs, being around another lifestyle, having people carry guns, do things, you know, that some of the people that I mentor and train now have those, but they don't have what I had, which was a strong support group, because I couldn't bring a lot of that stuff home that I did to my parents. I had to hide a lot of it. My friends, they wanted to fight me one time. I stole some donuts at UWM at a basketball program, which they all did, but they looked at me, man, you're supposed to be going to college. You don't do this. So I had that kind of support. And when I know that there's a fight and I can know how to help you win that fight, I believe I have an obligation to do that. And through all of the things that I've been through and the challenges I've had in my life, when I did start my first company, actually, with a partnership with one of the guys that trained under me. It was called Pyramid Electric. 10 years after I had changed my lifestyle, we had grossed $1.1 million. And now people think, oh, you're a millionaire. Well, $1.1 million, if you spent $1.3 million, you're still losing. But it was a milestone to reach that million peak, and then the next year we did even better. It really brought tears to my eyes because of from where I came from. And I never thought that I could see these type things happen in my life. And so it was kind of like I made a promise to God. So I kind of dedicated that I would help other people who've had similar pasts and had similar circumstances where you thought the world was against you, you thought you couldn't succeed, you can only go so far. So I tried to teach the people that they can do whatever they set their mind to. It ain't going to be easy. It wasn't easy in my journey, but it's possible and it's worthwhile.
Right. And you set that expectation up front too. And it seems like your mom was really someone who instilled that community service as a value in your life. I want to ask, like, can you tell me more about the electricians that you help mentor and the skills that they learned through this program, not just the technical skills?
Yeah. One of the top success stories, he's going to be speaking at our May 7th trade event this year at the Trade Hotel. And he came and talked to some of the Community Reintegration Center guys that I trained, the last graduating group, because he was in the House of Correction when I met him. But I could tell he wanted it. And he came in with some kind of carpentry skills, work with them on their math. Some of them don't have up to par math, but I'm like, if you don't have math, don't even worry about it. We're going to skip over everything else. I'll get you to the math area. And 2 years later, he's released from the House of Correction. He's working with me. A year after that, he's helping me run my business. I could stay away from it, and he knew what I wanted to do. He was good at it. You could see he was going to be successful. We got some houses, and I believe with the Mary program with the city, and he said, "Damn, I'd love to get that house right there." I said, "I'll tell you what, I'll talk to Don, we'll keep the price down, let you do a lot of the work, I'll donate the electrical work." And we wound up being able to sell it to that house to him on a land contract for about $50,000. He did all of the work inside, most of all of the work inside. He worked on it weekends, and you know, I helped him with the electrical and my team. And he wanted to get his family back together in his own house. So after he got the house, he said, "Jim, I got an offer from a large manufacturer to work making about $40 an hour." I said, "Man, you got to take it. You don't owe me anything." He took that job. Within a few months, he came and gave us a check to pay the rest of the house off. Now the house has tripled in value. When he came and talked to my guys a few weeks ago, he said, "You know, I bought another house now, and I'm getting ready to take my master's test." Oh. I love the fact, and I told him he did this the right way. I've had numerous guys, at least 8 to maybe 10 of them, and almost all of these ex-felons, people who were street hustlers or thought chronically unemployed, and you know, thought like me one time, is this the way life is? But they're master electricians with their own companies now. We got a lot of journeyman guys. Some of the guys I see still at Home Depot in place, and they'll whisper, "Hey, Jim, and she, Jim, you still work with the Ezekiel Hope program?" "Yeah, why are you whispering?" "I met you when I was in the house correction." I said, "Man, you ain't in the house correction now. Don't worry about it. You in Home Depot. You obviously are doing something that you're still in that field." So we plant a lot of seeds. And they always, I always talk about the with them with these guys. I got one guy that got, he was a real, real, real pretty rough guy. And I met him through the Running Rebels. He said, "Jim, this guy wants to shadow you. You know, I'm a little bit busy running all over the place." And so finally, he left a paper in my office, his resume, 4.5 average at MATC. He's doing extra credit everywhere. He's tutoring people in math at MATC. You know, that caught my eye. And volunteering for Habitat. You look at his prison record, you're like, this is not the same guy doing it. I owed him a talk to. So we talked. He came and worked with me for a little while. I said, "I'll give you a job." He said, "Jim, with all due respect, I want to be an industrial electrician for the union." I signed him a letter of recommendation. He got accepted into the union. He got in trouble one time after that. And then we talked, and I saw some of his past slip out. "Jim, I'm this." I said, "If you're that, be the best at that and leave this alone. Don't shadow that fence going back and forth, because it ain't going to work. You're going to fail in both of them." And I don't think he ever had anybody really talk to him like that. So he did go ahead and get his journeyman. He ran jobs for the company he was with then. Really, really great, smart dude. And so now he bought a trucking company. He was teaching some of his guys to get out of jail the trucking business. So he's an electrician and owning a trucking business. And then one day someone didn't take a truck to Florida. He said, "Jim, I got to take a leave of absence and drive this truck." Drove it to Florida. He said, "Jim, this trucking money is really crazy." And he drove out west. And when he got out west, he said, "I ain't never coming back. I'll use this as a $38 an hour fallback." So now he's got a few trucks. He's expanded his business and doing really well. And I love to talk about those success stories, because anybody that comes to, the only reason I probably haven't given this thing up yet is I know there are a couple of people like those people still out there that are trying to, you know, find their way and make their niche in life. And we always find reasons to give up, excuses not to do something. But I tell people there are two type of people. One makes excuses, one makes it happen. And I just try to mentor these guys that can be you, or you can be better than that, you know. You can learn from the mistakes that we made and take it even further.
Right. And can you tell me about the homes that trainees with Ezekiel Hope help rehab, and who are the homes for?
Well, when we rehab the home, we try to make sure that the house isn't going to need any work for 5 years. We put new wiring, new mechanicals, new water heaters, new furnaces in there, because the home buying expense is huge. We try to target low to moderate income, people in the inner city, people of brown and black, and first-time home buyers. Try to help them create generational wealth and turn the thing around for them. And again, I always talk about that with them, the what's in it for me. What I want to see these people do is turn around and help somebody else. reach down and show what transpired in your life, what helped you get out of the rut, what helped you buy a house, what helped you learn how to fix a house. Pass that knowledge down. Again, that's fulfilling when you see some of these people who never thought they were going to be homeowners.
Well, before we wrap up, I want to ask you, Milwaukee Magazine Unity Awards, it's meant to recognize change makers in the community who, that is clearly you. What does this award mean to you?
Recognition is good. I hope the recognition means that other people will see that if we're leaders, we're servants. And I truly believe that we owe it to the world, to our loved ones. We owe it to God, people in general. We owe it to each other to make each other better. And if we can help, I always say we're greater together. You know, we have more similarity than we do have differences. Sometimes we focus on the differences, but that's what this Unity Award kind of brings out to me more so. Everybody has a similar goal: live happily, have a happy, loving family, happy friends, food on your table, roof over your head. Everybody's got the same goals. And it means a lot to be able to help somebody else achieve the goal. And one of the things in this journey that I've noticed, and I always tell my guys, that once you start doing the right thing for the right reasons, that's when miracles happen. I've seen so many things in these last 15, 20 years and more. I look over my past and everything that has happened, I can see where it ties in to make me who I am. And then I look at some of the things that I didn't understand why that happened, and now it brings light to it. Sometimes now I expect something great to happen. You know, and that's better than expecting something bad to happen. Mm-hmm. No, it's a good feeling to have. And I just want people to try that. Just, you know, do the right things for the right reasons and watch get the right results.
That's a good motto.
It's amazing. And I truly do believe that that's God's message to me, you know.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's been such a pleasure to learn more about you, and I appreciate you sharing your work with me.
Thank you.
Jim Gaylord is a master electrician, vice president of Ezekiel Community Development Corporation, and CEO of Wire Electric. He spoke with Like Effects, Xgrid Nunez. You can find an article about Gaylord and other Unity Award winners in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break, and then we'll hear from two local musicians about their new jazz album. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Two Milwaukee musicians recently released an album that's a jazzy twist on the musical Fiddler on the Roof. Some of the songs were even recorded on the roof of a local synagogue. WUWM's Mayon Silver talked to vibraphonist Mitchell Shiner and Hazan, aka Cantor, and flautist Jeremy Stein about the project.
When you get a couple of musicians in a studio together, they've got to jam. Whether that's on a melodica or a flute. That includes the soulful tunes of tradition, the opening number of Fiddler on the Roof, which is a musical about a Jewish milkman, Tevye. He's living in a Russian town called Anatevka in the early 1900s, navigating persecution, but also changing times. Jeremy Stein and Mitchell Shiner have broken out into an impromptu version of the number. It's also on their new album, On the Roof, Jazz Impressions of Fiddler, which they recorded in part in a studio and in part on the roof of the Beth Israel Synagogue in Glendale, where Stein works as a cantor. whole thing came about because Stein likes to go up on his synagogue roof and think. And one day, it dawned on him that he should play up there with Shiner and a whole band.
And I brought Mitch, the next time he was with me, I brought him up. I said, Mitch, I brought him out on the roof. I said, we're going to do a concert on the roof. And he looked at me.
You have a deadpan face.
Right. And I said, we're going to play jazz impressions of Fiddler on the Roof, on the roof. He said, that sounds crazy. Let's do it.
Let's do it. And then I said, followed up with, does your insurance allow for something like this?
Here's one of Stein's flute solos. Shiner calls him a jazzy chazan. Chazan is the Hebrew word for cantor.
Yeah, so that's the scale that I was playing, which goes very naturally with that music. Is if you were in a klezmer environment, you would call it phrygish. If you were in a synagogue environment, you would call it a havarabba. It's the scale. And you get these notes. And
Is that the fifth mode of harmonic minor?
It is, more or less.
More thereabouts?
Yeah. And a lot of different cultures have that scale in it, but in a Jewish context.
Jews really dig it.
Yes.
Yeah. Something inside of me awakens with that sound, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Shiner notes that all cantors are fabulous singers, and many can play guitar and other instruments.
But I don't know too many cantors or chazans who can shred jazz flute. I mean, that is absolutely something so special and unique about Jeremy.
Shiner, who plays vibraphone on the album, gets out of the box in his solos as well, infusing them with a deep understanding of jazz and Latin jazz traditions and Jewish spirit.
I mean, a big part of the jazz tradition is the blues tradition, of course, and I tried to blend a little bit of that harmonic minor sound, but also throw in a lot of blues licks as well.
Fiddler on the Roof is well known for favorites like Tradition, To Life, and If I Were a Rich Man. Shiner and Stein's album has renditions of those, but also lesser-known tracks. Like this version of Do You Love Me, which is originally a duet between Tevye, the main character, and Golde, his wife, after he asks her if she loves him after 25 years of marriage. Shiner and Stein play it as a duet between flute and vibraphone. Here's Stein.
It was just this very back and forth conversation. And I thought, wouldn't it be funny if Mitch and I recreated that conversation, just the two of us? And that's that track I'm playing alto flute, which is a larger, lower version of the standard flute. And I thought that would be a nice way to embody Tevye, the baritone.
Proceeds from the rooftop concert where Shiner and Stein recorded some of the album went to organizations supporting housing advocacy in Milwaukee, like Pathfinders, Jewish Family Services, and Ovation Communities, Jewish Senior Living. So it's Fiddler on the Roof on a roof to support roofs.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
exactly.
Getting roofs over people's heads.
There's a free album release party open to the public on Sunday, February 23rd at 4 p.m. at Beth Israel Ner Tamid Synagogue in Glendale. The album will be on sale for $18, with profits going to the Synagogue Social Action Committee. 18 is a special number in Jewish numerology, signifying life. So I suppose we could say, to life. To life, to life, l'chaim. For Lake Effect, I'm Mayan Silver.
That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Susan Bentz, Chuck Hornbach, Jimmy Gutierrez, and Mayan Silver from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Madernowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarra-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon, where we'll break down the responsibilities of a state superintendent and bring you the latest local politics news in Capitol Notes. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.